Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent turmoil in the Trump campaign following the firing today of Corey Lewandowski, Trump's campaign manager, who has been the gatekeeper constantly at Trump's side, controlling access and preventing GOP lobbyist and consultant Paul Manafort, who was brought in to professionalize the campaign, from exercising influence over the erratic candidate. Dan Schnur, the director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute for Politics at USC, who worked on 4 presidential and 3 gubernatorial campaigns and was the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of John McCain, joins us to discuss the Trump campaign's apparent inability to shift from its primary campaign mode into a general election national campaign, and reports that Lewandowski kept insisting that letting Trump be Trump was a winning strategy for the White House, while Manafort has been arguing that his time for Trump to be more presidential. Then we'll assess the votes in the U.S. Senate today on gun control measures following the latest shooting massacre in Orlando. Saul Cornell, the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect, and The Second Amendment Goes to Court, joins us to discuss the glimmer of hope dashed today by gutless politicians in the NRA's pocket, who again defied the will of a majority of Americans outraged over the massacre of first graders in Newtown, then the murder of co-workers in San Bernardino, and now the killing of 49 at a nightclub in Orlando. We'll examine if and when the American people will be able to get Congress to do something to stop the serial slaughtering of our citizens, or at least stop terrorism suspects from buying assault rifles and explosives. Then finally, we'll look into the Supreme Court's 5-3 ruling handed down today that Justice Sotomayor slammed in a blistering dissent as a step towards an American police state. Bruce Fein, a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Reagan administration and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall, joins us to discuss the latest shredding of the Fourth Amendment that will now allow police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, and check if you have outstanding parking tickets, even if you have done nothing wrong. And joining us now is Dan Schnur, who is the director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California, one of California's leading political and media strategists. His record includes work on 4 presidential and 3 gubernatorial campaigns, and he served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Schnur.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And likewise. And Dan, since you've run a number of campaigns, including a presidential campaign for Senator John McCain, I take it all of these collective endeavors include a bit of political infighting. I guess it goes with the territory. But it seems that the Trump campaign has really taken that to a height. And there's finally been a showdown today. I guess for a while there's been something of a brewing showdown behind the scenes between Paul Manafort and Corey Lewandowski. But I don't know that Donald Trump used his famous line, "You're fired," but in this case, Lewandowski's out. So how would you assess it in the overall scheme of presidential campaigns?
Well, I think you made a great point a moment ago, which is, to some degree, these kind of disagreements are part and parcel of any large-scale campaign effort, and for that matter, part and parcel of any large-scale effort of any type. That said, at least my experience shows that the longer a candidate has been involved in politics, him or herself, the more likely he or she is to develop a loyal group of supporters who get very good and working together comfortably. When you're newer to the process and you put together your team on the fly the way Mr. Trump has, the potential for discord grows. And given some of the controversies that have surrounded Trump's campaign, obviously they grew to an unacceptable level in the disagreements between Lewandowski on one side and Paul Manafort on the other.
But I guess the basic disagreement, at least this is what the press is reporting, that Lewandowski kind of was clinging to the idea that and insisting that letting Trump be Trump was a winning strategy for the White House, while Paul Manafort, who I believe was brought in to professionalize the campaign, has been arguing that it is time for Trump to be more presidential. But this is all in the context of one Lewandowski clinging to a successful primary strategy and Manafort impatiently saying, wait a minute, we got to develop a national strategy here.
Well, I think that's right, although I would make this point. While Lewandowski, to a large degree, has been somewhat of an enabler of Trump's natural instincts, I doubt very much that he has plotted out a strategy that has directed Trump to say and do many of the things he has said and done. So it's not entirely clear that the removal of poor Lewandowski from his job will immediately and magically turn Donald Trump into a more conventional, more subdued candidate. That may be what Paul Manafort will push, and Trump may be more inclined to listen if he's not getting contrary advice from another senior staffer. But ultimately, the decisions on how Donald Trump conducts himself on the campaign trail are not being made by either Manafort or Lewandowski. They're being made by Trump himself. And the question is whether Trump made the decision today in order to placate the more establishment Republicans whose support he needs for the campaign, or if it signals a genuine reappraisal on his own part about the way he's conducted his campaign.
Well, press reports indicate that it was the children in particular. I believe it was Ivanka, the daughter, who apparently he does listen to, Trump, that have been weighing in, basically. I don't know whether they've been weighing on Manafort's behalf, but they've been basically weighing in to get rid of Lewandowski, who apparently has been something of a gatekeeper. He's been constantly at Trump's side, controlling access, and he's supposedly been preventing Manafort from getting his messages and ideas across to professionalize the campaign. At least that's what we're told.
Well, and the media accounts that I've seen have made essentially that case. But it is worth noting that the most impactful aspects of Trump's campaign, for both the helpful in the primary and the less helpful in recent weeks, have not been the result of considered strategy on anyone's part, save that of Trump's himself. The question, which I don't think anyone is qualified to answer right now, is will Trump, in the absence of Corey Lewandowski, adopt a more measured, more traditional type of approach to the campaign? There's no indication from his prior conduct that that's likely, but I suppose we'll see.
Well, so put yourself then in the shoes of trying to run a campaign when you've got a candidate who basically does what he wants and does what his instincts tell him. Can you think of any comparisons? I mean, is Trump really so much of a kind of rogue candidate who talk about let Trump be Trump? There's no way you can prevent Trump from being Trump, right? Is that
It appears that that's exactly right. What seems to be Trump's greatest difficulty right now is processing the idea that a general election audience is going to respond very differently than a Republican primary electorate. Everyone's a victim of their own success. And Donald Trump won the Republican nomination over the predictions of all the so-called experts by conducting himself in a certain way that was very successful to him. The challenge for him now is realizing that even though that worked for him in the spring, with a primary electorate, the nature of a general election audience is a much different one, and it's generally considered important to adjust. We'll see whether that takes place or not in the weeks ahead. It certainly hasn't for the last several weeks.
Well, don't you have to add to that the deficit that Trump has built up in terms of insulting women, minorities, and others? The assumption has been that now he has to moderate his stance and even try and win back some of the ground he's lost, if indeed that is possible.
I think we're essentially saying the same thing. This approach, for better or worse, did bring him to the Republican nomination. It appears that it will require a different type of approach to make a competitive candidate in a general election. It also appears that he hasn't come to terms with that yet.
But so is your sense, though, that there is a finite number of Trump supporters out there I mean, obviously, in primary campaigns, the more motivated partisan voters come out, either on the Republican side or the Democratic side. But is it fairly well established that there isn't any more of a pool that he can tap into, that he really has to broaden his message? Do we really know? I mean, does he really know what the facts and figures are? I mean, I've never seen anything like the defections taking place, the disquiet, the number of senior Republicans, the number of even delegates now organizing a belated Stop Trump campaign. I have to admit, this is a pretty extraordinary campaign in terms of dissent within the party itself, in this case, the Republicans.
Well, there is no precedent, at least in modern American politics, for this type of discord. Theoretically, you could argue that the Democrats in 1968, at the height of the Vietnam War, were involved in a similar type of fratricide, but that was a much different set of circumstances, and it has been almost a half century. I guess the question going forward, and to answer your first question, at least right now, there is a finite number of Trump supporters with what seems to be a very hard ceiling that he's a difficult surpassing. The question is whether a different approach from him could allow that ceiling to rise. The answer to that is probably yes. But the next logical question is that something he's interested or capable to do?
Well, if he continues to let Trump be Trump and defy the advice, the assumption would be that the move that's just taken place would increase the influence of Manafort and those that want him to be more presidential. But is there a way, do you think, to blunt this disquiet that's going on with so many? I take it a lot of the Congress and Senate are worried about the down-ballot damage that it could do to their chances. Is there anything to sort of stop this Dump Trump campaign? It's come and gone in a couple of incarnations, but it's not going away.
Well, I think the odds of it being successful, of these delegates actually removing him as the nominee, I think the odds against that are fairly strong. That said, the only thing that is going to ultimately cause Trump's detractors within the Republican Party to cease those efforts is for Trump to begin to campaign in a more traditional and more measured way. And as we've talked about a few times already, it's not to say that it's impossible for him to do that, but there's also nothing to indicate that it's something he's likely to want to do.
Well, so far, whenever he's sort of gone on script and used the teleprompter, he's not made any secret of the fact that he finds this kind of boring. You know, it feels like he's got the shackles on. So perhaps the chances of him of sort of knuckling under and being scripted are pretty remote.
Well, I think that's right. It's not to say that it can't happen, but there's no evidence in the recent past to suggest that it will.
So just in the last minute or so then, Dan Schneur, what's your sense? You're a former Republican, you're now an independent. Do you have a feeling that a lot more people are going to be taking your journey because of the Trump phenomenon? I mean, I've never seen anything like the kind of anger and outrage and dissent that you say it's unprecedented. It certainly seems that way to me.
Well, the trend toward increased number or increased percentages of independent voters, or as we're known in California, no party preference voters, that trend line well predates Donald Trump. Almost one quarter of California voters are now registered no party preference, and among the millennial generation, it's closer to one third. Trump, no question, will accelerate that trend, although I suspect that Secretary Clinton will as well. But over the years, I think it's much more likely than not that much larger numbers of voters across the ideological spectrum will register to vote, but very specifically register outside the confines of the two major parties.
Well, just in closing, do you think Trump is going to make it to November, that there's not, even if short of some kind of effort to dump him at the convention, which is now being discussed, what about the possibility of him simply going off in a huff? Because he seems at times, many people have thought that he really wanted to sort of, you know, improve his brand, almost entered it not so much as a lark, but as a way to improve his brand. And my God, he finally, it kind of surprised him. Somebody described it as the dog who caught the fire truck, you know. So is there an element there, do you think? Or is he going to stay in all the way to the end?
Well, he appears to have been somewhat surprised by his early successes. It certainly looked like he was originally running to prove a point or to make some noise or to gain some attention. And he did seem a little bit taken aback when he realized how much support he was gathering. Will he stay in or not? I wish I could make an intelligent prediction. I'll simply admit to you and your listeners that every prediction I've made about Donald Trump for the last 53 weeks has been wrong. So I'm learning to stay away from that temptation.
Well, Dan Schneider, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Schneider, who's the director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California, one of California's leading political and media strategists. His record includes work on 4 presidential and 3 gubernatorial campaigns, and he served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back assessing the votes in the U.S. Senate today on gun control measures following the latest shooting massacre in Orlando.
Well, some people try and treat me like a man. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. Well, I guess they just don't understand. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. They think I know, but that's just it. I'm a child.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, who's the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair in American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and the Origin of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Thank you for having me.
And as predicted, the Senate voted today on two Republican and two Democratic amendments. The two Democratic amendments by Senator Cornyn and by Senator Grassley were both crafted by the NRA. Grassley's amendment would have actually undone some of the money that goes towards background checks and also would have watered down some of the restrictions on mentally ill people getting guns. And Cornyn's amendment wouldn't have done anything to prevent terrorists from getting hold of assault weapons and explosives in any meaningful way. It was all in the name of protecting a minority of people on the terror watch list. There are 81,000 people on the terror watch list, so it's pretty extraordinary that you couldn't come up with a regime that would somehow get them off the list so that they could go off and buy guns rather than allow the 81,000 on the list to buy guns. I mean, how crazy is this?
Well, I think we're setting new standards for crazy in America. I mean, I think there's no question by the standards of any of the industrial democracies, even before this vote, we were such a statistical outlier. And I think in light of what's happened recently, both in Orlando and the rhetoric leading up to this vote, you're absolutely right. We're dealing with a very, very small number of people who might somehow have the right to purchase a firearm blocked or temporarily blocked, and we're weighing that as much more significant than another, you know, 5 Orlandos down the road. It's kind of hard to get your head around.
Well, the 4 votes, of course, Feinstein's vote went down as well as Murphy's amendment, and Murphy conducted the senator from Connecticut, conducted a filibuster that was the only reason that any of these votes were put up. And then you have the Republicans putting up 2 amendments to neutralize the efforts on the part of the Democrats to actually do something. So the whole exercise is so incredibly cynical.
Yes, I think we've definitely seen new lows in terms of what Congress won't do about solving problems. I mean, and of course, Congress's popularity rating was already hovering close to zero. So, you know, they have set a new low, which is almost mathematically impossible to imagine, but somehow they did it.
So going back in history, and you, which you have done in your book, Well-Regulated Militia, the Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? That book makes it really clear that the Second Amendment, which all of the NRA people treat as though it's, you know, the bedrock of the Constitution, actually, arguably, the Second Amendment was, in fact, a gun control measure.
Well, yes. I mean, one of the things that's hard for people who are so busy spouting the Second Amendment, who don't take the time to really understand it, is to realize that, in fact, the Second Amendment imposes obligations on the citizenry in a way that none of the other amendments do. I mean, you can't be forced to vote, you can't be forced to practice your religion, you can't be forced to publish your thoughts, but you can be forced to bear arms. And so the Second Amendment was always very different than the freedoms embodied in the First Amendment. And one part of the Second Amendment that is particularly relevant to today's debate, and which we hear nothing about, is the part that talks about the security of a free state. The Second Amendment was always about promoting safety and security, and we've reached the situation where if you add up the number of deaths as a result of gun violence since 1968, that has now surpassed all the deaths on battlefields in all of American history. So you really have to ask in a very basic way whether our gun policies are actually increasing or decreasing the security of this free state that we're trying to protect.
Well, indeed, I think the last two massacres, at least the San Bernardino massacre and the massacre in Orlando, because they were done in the name of Daesh, the Islamic State, and it's difficult to know whether this person in Orlando had any real connections. In San Bernardino, there's some ambiguity about the wife being possibly connected to ISIS. But this guy in Orlando at the last minute claimed he was an Islamic soldier, he called himself. But arguably, this situation with homegrown terrorists, I mean, what the Republicans are arguing is it's all Obama's fault that he hasn't gotten rid of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But it's clearly, even if you bombed every Daesh terrorist out of existence, they'd still have operatives abroad. And that's what's happening. I mean, they're not even operatives. They're people that are sort of self-radicalized. So it is becoming a kind of national security issue. So you can't have it both ways. You can't want to fight your war on terror at the same time allow the potential terrorists within this country to buy assault weapons and explosives.
Well, exactly. And it's interesting because if we look at people who've died as a result of terrorism on American soil since 9/11, the number who've died from gun violence far exceeds the number that have died as a result of overt acts of terrorism without guns. So by any standard, if we're actually genuinely concerned about terrorism, guns have to be part of the equation. We have made it somewhat more difficult to gain the kind of chemicals you need to create some of these bombs. We certainly have made it more difficult to get onto a plane with potentially dangerous things that can be converted into weapons or that are weapons. The one area where we refuse to make any progress and take even the most minimal steps is guns, and that's, of course, because unlike terrorism, there are gun manufacturers, and there is a gun lobby. So we don't have a terrorism lobby. We don't have a terrorism industry. But we do have these very vested financial interests, which are making a lot of money. In fact, you know, as someone pointed out, Barack Obama is probably either the first or second greatest firearm salesman in American history after Samuel Colt. Not intentionally, of course, but he has been great for the gun industry because they play upon the fears that he's coming to take our guns away.
And again, I'm speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. Well, of course, your latest book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court, that was the Heller decision, and that was largely the work of Scalia, the justice who died recently, and that turned the whole Second Amendment on its head. And that really set any efforts at gun control back enormously, because the context of the Second Amendment was the state shall have well-regulated militias. And then the second part was, and citizens' right to bear arms should not be infringed. So, you know, how do you undo that? I mean, in other words...
Well, here's the really interesting thing about that. We just had a decision in the Ninth Circuit, which, of course, is in your part of the world, on the West Coast, dealing with concealed carry. And what the Ninth Circuit did was a really fascinating exercise in what I call originalist jujitsu, which is they actually took the logic of Scalia's opinion in Heller and turned it against the gun rights argument. Scalia basically said, you know, the right to bear arms is protected with the scope that it enjoyed when it was written. But, of course, he didn't really know enough history to know what that scope was. But by doing that, he actually opened up the door to do some serious historical research. And what the Ninth Circuit did, using several different recent scholarly works, including an article I wrote, was to show that there was no tradition of having a protected right to carry a concealed weapon. So in an odd way, Scalia thought he was opening the door to gun rights and closing the door on gun control, but because his history was so bad, he actually has opened up a huge front for regulating firearms that he never anticipated.
But still, if you can't get something passed after Sandy Hook, where first graders were slaughtered, and the entire population was outraged, and there was a clear majority behind Obama to get something done, nothing got done because of the NRA. Then after San Bernardino, efforts were made. And now after Orlando, today in the Senate, we've seen the power of the NRA once again block any sensible efforts to deal with this problem. So we are left with the situation of we have in this country the best armed criminals, the best armed terrorists, even if you're on the no-fly list and you're a terrorist suspect in this country, you can buy an assault weapon and explosives. This is unbelievable, and it continues. So where do you see, having just said that there's a possible way to undo Heller or to turn it on, sort of blow it up in Scalia's face, where do you see the hope?
Well, I think we need to distinguish between what is constitutionally permissible and what the American people are willing to do politically. Those are two radically different bars, if you will. So, I mean, the problem is our political bar is set so abysmally low, we don't even get close to running into a problem constitutionally because we don't have the political will to do anything. So the real question is how many bodies and whose bodies? I mean, we've had pretty horrific levels of gun violence directed at young African-American males in inner cities. That clearly has not produced a response. We obviously saw Newtown, which at least had the response of energizing victims of gun violence, but still was not enough to change politics at the national level. So the question is, how many more Orlandos before it will hurt enough that the American people will finally demand from their politicians some action? Because, you know, the strength of the NRA rests on several things. Obviously, they have a lot of money, and they have a lot of very talented lobbyists. But it's also that they have an army of people who harass representatives and who vote only on this issue. So the question is, when will it be as painful for politicians to oppose these common sense measures? How many bodies do we need to get to that point? And when that happens, we'll actually finally see change. But of course, you know, that's a horrific thing to imagine, that the you know, 30,000 a year isn't enough. So, you know, how many is?
So, in effect, you think it's going to take something like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, some lobbying group of citizens who have just seen too much violence and had their, I mean, what, 30,000 a year? There's a lot of family members, right, that are impacted.
Well, and actually one of the things that's happened since Newtown, and thanks to social media, is we actually have seen, I mean, the Mothers Demand Action now has 3.5 members. That puts it very close to the NRA, whose membership is sort of, you know, a secret number, but is probably not more than about 5 or 6 million, which is a tiny fraction of gun owners, and even tinier fraction of the American population. So, and that is what's kept the issue alive. The question is, given the bizarre nature of American politics and the structure of the Senate and the gerrymandering of other legislative offices, when will it hurt people in South Dakota? When will it hurt people in Missouri? I mean, we actually have many more people involved in this issue, but the question is, given the dysfunctions of our representative system, when will people in places that are now safe seats for the NRA actually have to deal with levels of gun violence that cause them to change their policies?
Well, with just 5 million members of the NRA and 310 million firearms in America, which is one for every American, basically, the real issues are, how do you get more than 5 million people? Doesn't seem like a heavy lift, but what funds the NRA and allows them to exercise blackmail over congressmen is that if you don't go along with us, we will fund the campaign of somebody opposing you in the primary. If you're a left winger, you'll be further to the left, and if you're a right winger, it'll be further to the right, and we'll do you in. That's the tactic that they can use. They can only exercise that leverage because they get money from the gun manufacturers and the ammunition manufacturers. So this is going to take, you know, I guess, does it take more money than Bloomberg has?
Well, that's an interesting question. There is the problem that there is a gun industry, but there's no peace industry that donates a dollar every time, you know, you go to the peace store the way there is every time you go to the gun store. But the kind of startup capital that Bloomberg provided has at least allowed mothers to find their voice to get 3.5 million members. So things are improving, but I agree, it is hard when you have such a powerful industrial group who actually is really the most interesting case of special interest lobbying, because unlike many other industries, the gun lobby has almost complete immunity from civil liability, so we can't even apply pressure the way you did against cigarette companies or against car manufacturers, and you can't even do the research, with CDC. So there are things quite apart from actually banning weapons that, you know, might yield some positive results. That maybe if we can't do what these bills that were currently voted down, maybe at least we can get money flowing to do research. Maybe we can at least change the blanket immunity of the gun industry so that you can sue them if you have a legitimate grievance, and we can let juries decide whether or not damages instead of just blanket prohibitions. I mean, it's very weird. It's not a very American value to say you don't have access to court if you have a grievance. That, you know, it's a deeply held American value that everyone should have their day in court, but of course not when it comes to guns.
Well, of course, that issue came up in the Democratic presidential primaries between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. She accused Sanders of voting against the efforts to remove immunity from gun manufacturers. And in terms of research for the CDC, so we can at least get the basic information about what damage unrestricted guns in the hands of criminals and mentally ill people and terrorists in this country does to our society, it's not as if that can't be revisited, right?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, we wouldn't have to take anyone's guns away to allow the CDC to do more research, and we could, you know, I mean, the thing that's really horrible about the immunity we've given the gun industry, it's not like we said, look, we're going to cap damages, or, you know, we're concerned that juries may be too emotional, so we're going to require some different process to go through. We basically denied people any access to the courts, and that is really quite astonishing, that there simply is no legal recourse for someone who believes that, you know, a gun manufacturer has been dumping guns in a particular region, knowing full well that many of them have to be being sold to, you know, dubious parties. You know, that we couldn't, that would never happen with any other commodity. We would never let that happen. We would never say to Americans, look, we're just going to prevent you from going to court. You have no right to a remedy. That is a very un-American value, yet that is a value that the NRA has written into law. It's just astonishing that we can't even get these outrageous things. You know, we can't even let ATF use computers to run background searches on guns used in crimes. I mean, you know, you're still having to go through paper, and this is the 21st century.
And, of course, if anybody's seen any of these detective crime shows on television, the first thing they do is they find the gun at the scene and trace it. I mean, it's not like when you find a gun at a crime scene, that is an instrument of death that's already killed somebody. The idea that you would not be able to find out who used it and who sold it, it's insane. Again, it's a part of this insanity we're talking about here, where terrorists in this country, or potential terrorists, are allowed to buy assault weapons. And thanks to the Republicans in the Senate today, they will continue to be able to buy assault weapons. Anyway, I'm obviously disgusted and distressed here, and I thank you for joining us, Saul Cornell.
Well, thank you for having me. Let's hope we can have a more rational and calm debate about moving forward, at least in Congress.
Again, I've been speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair in American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? His latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the Supreme Court's 5-3 ruling handed down today that shreds the Fourth Amendment. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. Green instead of gang bandanas, FBI spying on us through the radio antennas, and I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society with no respect for the people's right to privacy. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live, bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons, dying over money and relying on religion for help. Hey, can you relate? We living in a police. No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secrets. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bruce Fein, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fein's the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein.
Thanks, Ian.
And Bruce, you're one of the leading champions of the Fourth Amendment, which is pretty tattered and torn at this point. We talked a lot about the Patriot Act and all of the post-9/11 anti-terrorism moves that have undermined the Fourth Amendment protections. But now the Supreme Court has decided in a 5-3 vote in a case called Utah versus Streiff, which has brought about a powerful dissent from Justice Sotomayor, who believes that this ruling is a move towards an American police state. And just quoting her, "Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language. This case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, and check it for outstanding traffic warrants, even if you are doing nothing wrong." That does sound like a police state.
I don't think it's much an exaggeration in terms of the rather
placency, the court's majority opinion, indicated for what was accepted as a violation of the Fourth Amendment, namely stopping someone without even reasonable suspicion they were implicated in drug trafficking, obtaining identification, and then just running a search of that name into a database that had warrants, and then finding that because there was a traffic warrant outstanding, justified an arrest, and then immediately upon the arrest searched the body of the arrestee and found drugs. But the court accepted that the initial stop was unconstitutional, yet there were no real consequences. And the argument could be made, well, he could still sue for damages for the unconstitutional stop, despite the conviction. But the likelihood of a jury awarding someone damages who has been convicted of a drug offense is zero or less. So it's a gaping, I think, weakness in the Fourth Amendment, and a part of, I think, a reflection of the societal disregard for the right to privacy, the right to be let alone from an omnipresent police force, police state, as you will. It's another element, too, that comes into play here, Ian, and that is, you know, what was the crime being investigated? You know, a traffic violation, and initially the unconstitutional stop was relating to, you know, selling marijuana. I mean, what have we become? If we try to examine, you know, the kind of privacy expectations that took hold at the time that the Fourth Amendment was ratified, there it was overwhelming because the number of laws that were enacted to regulate, you know, private activity was so few. The foundations for even the police force going out and asking any questions was relatively tiny. You know, today we've got thousands, tens of thousands of laws. So the ability of the authority of the government to invade your privacy is just monumentally greater than it was at the time of the Fourth Amendment. Yet someone as recently as the late Justice Scalia, in a case that's less than 10 years old, said the goal of the Fourth Amendment is to confer the same level of privacy upon a citizen in 1791 when the amendment was ratified as today. And that's clearly is a totally, you know, illusionary parallel with regard to the court's actual decisions.
So what explains then this complacency? Why did the five justices treat this as just a sort of a minor expansion of police powers when it has these extraordinary implications?
You know, Justice Holmes once said, you know, the life of the law is not logic, it's experience. And I think that the justices themselves are carried away with this, you know, empire psychology that seeks, you know, a risk-free existence. You know, all, and so we have a risk-free existence abroad. We go, anything that's the slightest danger, we turn into a war, no matter how unthreatening to our national security. And it bleeds over into what I call the surveillance state. The surveillance state of this type is an offshoot of the warfare state. If you want no risks, then you authorize surveillance of anybody at any time, any place, no matter how empty it is of any substance, of identifying, you know, a real culprit. And you can even see that with regard to some of the elements of statements made by Donald Trump and after Orlando, okay, anybody who looks like a Muslim, then we have to have racial profiling. You know, the risk level has to be zero. So if you want a risk level of zero, you spy on everybody and detain them without any cause whatsoever. And to say these things fit together seamlessly in this kind of attitude or psychology of, all right, let's say we can't handcuff the police. You know, if we want to be risk-free, we got to let them take whatever risk they want with the Fourth Amendment to ensure that even a drug trafficker or someone is guilty of a traffic violation doesn't escape our attention. And that is what this is. And this is just one case, I think, Ian, that's a symptom of this total contempt of the right to privacy, the right to be let alone. Now, and it's not just a personal element of privacy that's important here. One of the reasons why we should treasure privacy is that it enables the citizens to be free to challenge their government without worrying that there'll be retaliation and there'll be violations of their privacy and embarrassing information is leaked out and harassed. And if the citizenry feels that they're under the gun, they don't want to provoke anybody in any way, any police officers are not like them, they say, all right, well, let me just, I don't want to say anything about the government or the, you know, express my viewpoints that might be hostile to the government because they've got this power of retaliation and I don't have any Fourth Amendment to defend me anymore.
So in her dissent, which was quite blistering, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, in this search for law-breaking, the officers in this case himself broke the law. But clearly the idea that a policeman is breaking the law doesn't carry the same weight as a citizen's. But she went on to say, by legitimizing the conduct that produces this double consciousness, this case tells everyone, white and black, guilty and innocent, that an officer can verify your legal status at any time. It says that your body is subject to invasion while courts excuse the violation of your rights. It implies that you are not a citizen of a democracy, but the subject of a carceral state just waiting to be cataloged. Very powerful.
Yeah. It is, and I don't think it's an exaggeration either. The irony, Ian, is it's more important that the government comply with a law that turns square corners than the citizen, because as Justice Louis Brandeis pointed out years ago, you know, the government is the potent and omnipresent teaches. It teaches by example, and if the government becomes a lawbreaker, it invites every man and woman to become a law unto themselves. So this is where the concern for compliance with the law should be at its zenith when the government is at stake here. And, you know, it reminds me also of this rather Orwellian phrase that I encountered in reading the recent memoir of Michael Hayden, who was formerly director of the CIA National Security Agency. He talked about the challenges, Ian, of confronting the not yet guilty. Just think of that phrase, the not yet guilty. I mean, that's everybody, right? They haven't been convicted. You know, and this idea, well, you know, it's just a matter of we just don't have the proof on you, huh? You know, and that conveys, you know, a mindset that's totally antithetical to everything that we presume in the United States is fundamental, namely the liberty and privacy is the default position, and unless the government satisfies a not an insurmountable but a serious threshold of need, you got a right to just go on your own way and live life as you want to. Doesn't mean that some people might take advantage of it, you know, to do evil things, but that's some element of the price of liberty. If you want no risks, everybody's in prison, and then you have no liberty at all.
Well, I think after this Orlando massacre, we seem to be drifting in that direction of that you just quoted Michael Hayden's book.
Yeah.
In other words, when Hillary Clinton talks about we need to go after lone wolves, at the end of the day, what they're talking about is they're talking about some kid in a basement looking at dubious websites, a loner, etc. And then one day he sort of changes from a sort of sad loner in a basement in front of the computer all day into an assassin where he kills a bunch of people. But in order to go after that moment, if you will, or that threshold, you're essentially policing thoughts. And yeah. I've never, ever heard that before in a democracy, particularly the U.S. democracy, that you would be resorting to policing thoughts.
Yeah, well, exactly right, because thoughts remain thoughts. You know, you have an absolute right to think whatever you want. Actions are different, but what else is freedom of the mind and freedom to think and contemplate whatever you want? As long as you keep it to yourself, not harming anyone else, you may discard thoughts that initially you thought were convincing and unotherwise. But unless, you know, you have actually actions that threaten others, that's utterly ridiculous to get in the business of mind reading and, oh, you know, you had a dream that we didn't like, you know, to do X, Y, Z. And part of this, I think, Ian, comes from the understanding that a lot of people get frustrations, you know, they're able to overcome them by just thinking things that they're angry, they're doing this, that. They don't actually do anything, but it's kind of catharsis to just think about, well, I wish X, Y, Z, and I think this is unfair. You move on because that catharsis dissipates you know, the kinetic energy that might cause you to actually do something that's a crime. And, of course, then you can be caught and prevented from committing the crime or punished if we can't catch you in advance. So that's an important element of everybody's knowledge of human nature. That's why we want freedom. And most people can get rid of their anxieties or their neuroses, you know, by ways that don't require violence, criminal activity, but they have to have some way of demonstrating or expressing or feeling a frustration or a disagreement with the status quo.
Well, we sure come a long way from the American Revolution that, of course, sparked the Fourth Amendment. And I remember you quoted to me once a great speech. I think it was made.
Yeah, I'll do it right now if you don't indulge me. And the answer is right. This is the spirit of the Fourth Amendment. It was William Pitt the Elder to the British Parliament in 1763. And he says, "The poorest man in his cottage may bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, the roof may shake, the storms may enter, the rains may enter, the wind may blow through it, but the King of England cannot enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement." Now, that's the spirit of the Fourth Amendment, you know, and it's very inspiring. You know, the right, even the poorest beggar in his cottage, he can confront the king. You can't come in. And now, well, government can spy, do whatever they want. No, doesn't need probable cause. You know, everything is subordinated to safety. No, yeah, actually the word safety is not really in the Constitution. Liberty is there, but not safety. It's not because we don't care about it, but we recognize that without some ability to take some reasonable risks, there is no liberty. We're all detained. We're all the not yet guilty. You're the not yet guilty. I'm the not yet guilty. All your audience is the not yet guilty, and we're at large, you know? And then at that point, if we're all going to be detained, what's the purpose of having a democracy at that point?
Well, you just quoted in that quote the word threshold, and that seems to be key. And we talked a minute ago about the threshold of when somebody, a loner watching the internet all day, suddenly picks up a gun, and the idea that you have to police the thoughts in order to stop a lone wolf. Again, just to that threshold on this little cottage that the king can't enter, where is our threshold on the Fourth Amendment now?
Yeah, well, it apparently is been reduced to virtually zero. Because remember, you know, in this particular case, they didn't even have a reasonable suspicion to think this individual was engaged in wrongdoing. And of course, when you have the threshold of the not yet guilty, this was the so-called the NSA's the warrantless surveillance program. The threshold was, Ian, zero. They were collecting and continue to collect the information about your telephone and email metadata with no suspicion at all of anything. They're just collecting it, hoping that sometime in the future, maybe someone will call a number that maybe they can connect with. So that's the threshold, you know, is zero.
Well, and of course, that's the big data collection storage place, or whatever you want to call it, is being built up in Utah as we speak.
Yeah.
Massive, massive acreage of buildings that the NSA are going to be storing all this extraordinary data on. And here, of course, we have Utah versus Sharif, which I think is going to, I mean, is this going to wake up a lot of legal scholars? I mean, it's sort of gone under the radar. I know it just came out today, the ruling, but I see it as being quite tectonic.
Well, it is, but it's also, you know, a manifestation of a larger problem, because if it was just this case on itself, you know, it wouldn't be so worrisome. But it's part of this overall process of totally crippling, if not puncturing, the Fourth Amendment. You know, the whole idea that if you display any information about yourself to any third party, including Google or Yahoo or a server, then you lose Fourth Amendment protection. Because someone's looked at it, I mean, that's really Orwellian. I mean, you can't live in this day and age and communicate without sharing some of your communication with a third party. I mean, that's what the Internet age is about. And under the court's current doctrine, okay, you have no Fourth Amendment protection at all. Really? I mean, it's just stunning. But I go back and say it. The larger issue, which is very, very alarming, is that this is derivative of the warfare state, is the surveillance state. No risk life, okay. can't take any risk. We got to know everything we can about everybody at every time and every place. You know, we're Dr. John Poindexter's The Total Information Program. And one of the great ironies of this, Ian, is that the collection of information is so vast. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack and keep building the haystack bigger and bigger, which makes the likelihood of finding the needle more and more remote. Why are you doing that? We didn't have people. And if you go back and look even at 9/11, one of the reasons why, you know, there was the failure of detection, even though the information about, you know, the hijackers in San Diego calling a safe number in Sana'a, Yemen, because the wife of one of the hijackers was pregnant, the NSA couldn't process the damn information fast enough. So they even though it was there in their big haystack. And then they made up this idea, well, we didn't have enough surveillance capability, and that's why they got away, and that's why they went after the Patriot Act. But that wasn't really the case. The information was there. They just couldn't process it. And you can imagine the Buffdale, Utah. I mean, they have so much information. You know, they're great at collecting it, but what is it useful for if you can't analyze it? And that's why, you know, this idea that I think the idea that collecting more and more and more information, it gives what I would call the equivalent of a placebo effect. People just think, oh, well, we got the information. I feel better that they're collecting everything, even though it diminishes safety. You know, it has the opposite psychological effect, so it continues, even though its impact on thwarting terrorism is zero.
And, of course, there is no algorithm that can predict the future. But just in closing, Bruce Fine, just to quote more of Justice Sotomayor's blistering dissent in this ruling handed down today, that she believes, and so does Ruth Bader Ginsburg believe, is a step towards an American police state. Quoting Justice Sotomayor, "We must not pretend that the countless people who are routinely targeted by police are isolated. They are the canaries in the coal mine whose deaths, civil and literal, warn us that no one can breathe in this atmosphere. They are the ones who recognize that unlawful police stops corrode all our civil liberties and threaten all our lives. Until their voices matter too, our justice system will continue to be anything but." And, you know, the daughter of a Puerto Rican immigrant here to the United States, I think, speaks for countless minorities in this country who are routinely stopped by the police.
Well, yes, and this is what one of the things I think that's important in that statement, Ian, is the rich and the famous and the powerful, they don't need the law to protect them because politics does. They got power and influence to make sure that they aren't targeted by those in authority. The law is there at its highest to protect the weak politically. Because they can't make a phone call to the mayor's office or the police department, make a complaint like somebody who's got lots of money and makes donations and got an ability to exert other influence because of their status in society. And that's what makes this. The rich and the famous don't need to worry about this. You know, the police ain't stopping them for suspected drug trafficking violations. And that's one of the things that I think is so concerning about the decision, because we know to the extent it is expanded, it'll be on the underclass, not the upper class.
Well, Bruce Fine, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire, Before the Fall. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.